This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In January 2017, after serving as acting director for 6 months, Dr. David Strauss was appointed director of the Division of Applied Regulatory Science in the FDA Office of Clinical Pharmacology. Dr. Strauss assumes this position at a time when the advancement of regulatory science and its alignment with basic as well as clinical science are critically important, perhaps more important than ever, for developing and delivering new and improved therapies to patients who need them most. What is regulatory science? Does it have an impact? How? On whom? I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Strauss to discuss his perspective on applied regulatory science and related topics. I thank you, Dr. Strauss, for joining us today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to join your podcast today.
To get everyone on the same page, as director of the Division of Applied Regulatory Science, or CDER, what is your working definition of applied regulatory science?
Applied regulatory science involves developing new tools, standards, and approaches to assess safety, efficacy, quality, and performance of all FDA-regulated products. And in line with this, the Division of Applied Regulatory Science was created to move new science into the CDER review process and close the gap between scientific innovation and drug review. As you mentioned, we're located in the Office of Clinical Pharmacology and collaborate with offices throughout CDER, across FDA, other government agencies, academia, and industry. And our division is somewhat unique in that we perform mission-critical applied research and review across the translational research spectrum that includes in vitro and in vivo laboratory research, in silico computational modeling and informatics, and integrated clinical research covering clinical pharmacology, experimental medicine, and post-market analyses.
Your division is tasked with, as you mentioned, conducting what I would call benchmark research to inform FDA policy and maybe streamline some of the rate-limiting steps in the drug development process. You've cited a couple of examples already. Are there other specific examples, recent examples of this type of research? And what steps in the drug development process do these steps address?
We're very happy to publish a recent article in the DIA's journal, Therapeutic Innovation and Regulatory Science, that talks about how our division addresses issues throughout the drug development process. Much, but not all, of our work focuses on predictive models and biomarkers. And when I say predictive models, these can span in vitro cellular models, in vivo animal models, and in silico computer models. Let me tell you about two specific examples. The first one relates to effects of drugs on the heart. There were multiple drugs removed from the market a couple decades ago. You're likely familiar because they caused abnormal heart rhythms and sometimes sudden death. And we now have a test to predict whether drugs will cause this effect. However, the current approach is not very specific, and this means that some drugs can be flagged as having a risk when they are actually safe. So we are improving upon that test by combining data we get from multiple ion channels in the laboratory in a computer model to predict the risk in patients, and the results are checked in an assay with human-induced pluripotent stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes. This approach, which is called the Comprehensive In Vitro Proarrhythmia Assay, or CIPA, will be able to be applied at multiple steps in drug development, including to inform drug screening and candidate drug selection, and later in drug development, to inform when ECG monitoring is needed in clinical trials, and risk language in drug labels, And we presented this new paradigm to the Clinical Pharmacology and Pharmaceutical Sciences FDA Advisory Committee a few months ago. And the committee endorsed this new approach pending some ongoing validation studies. The second example I'd like to tell you about relates to novel in vivo models and biomarkers that can be applied in the pre-market setting. To get everyone on the same speed, a biomarker is a characteristic that is objectively measured and evaluated as an indicator of a normal biological process or a disease process or a response to a therapy, whether it's the therapeutic response or an adverse response that causes a safety event. And we have contributed to the development and validation of multiple biomarkers. For example, the first biomarker package submitted to FDA for qualification was for a set of acute kidney injury biomarkers, and our division provided early data on kidney injury biomarker behavior in animal models, and our research supported the context of use criteria. We have subsequently extended our biomarker work to novel genomic microRNA biomarkers of organ injury. And we identified and characterized microRNA biomarkers of acute pancreatic injury, leveraging next-generation sequencing. And informed by this work, a public-private consortium has started the process to formally qualify these microRNA biomarkers for regulatory use. Moving forward, we are now developing and testing additional novel humanized animal models that have a human immune system, a human liver, or both introduced into a mouse. And this is important because the immune system is very species specific, and traditional animal models often fail to detect immune-mediated adverse events, which is very important for some of the new cancer therapies like checkpoint inhibitors. So those are just a couple examples of applied regulatory science that we pursue to develop, test, and implement predictive models and biomarkers. And anyone interested in additional details can see our recent article in the DIA journal, Therapeutic Innovation and Regulatory Science.
Thank you. These are wonderful and specific examples that really help illuminate the work of your division. If I may maybe explore a little bit the inner workings within the Center for Drugs, how do the research ideas come into being? Does your division develop those ideas for projects and conduct the projects and then report the results? Do the review divisions commission or request that your division conduct specific projects, for example, around the biomarkers? And when you get the results from your research, do you publish the results internally or externally and put them out there? Or do you make recommendations to the review divisions to adopt your results and incorporate them into reviews of INDs and NDAs? How does this work?
We do a combination of all of those things. Our division works with the offices throughout CDER, the review divisions for new drugs, for generic drugs, the post-market analyses, and new projects will come to us first, where review divisions send our division a consult, and this can be for a very specific review issue that's emerged in drug development. They'll come to our division when there's something that's out of the ordinary, we don't understand the mechanism of action of a drug, or whether a potential safety signal that emerges in the pre-market or post-market setting is real. And this can lead initially to paper-based reviews, computational analyses. It then can lead to actual laboratory research. And then we will, in the short term, provide written reviews, consults back to the requester for research projects we publish in the peer-reviewed literature. And then we work with our colleagues on projects when appropriate in other government agencies such as NIH, with academic collaborators, and with industry through public-private partnerships. For instance, the Cardiac Safety Initiative I described for you is a large international collaboration with our global regulatory colleagues from Europe, from Japan, from Canada, with industry and academia coordinated through public-private partnerships. So we pursue research based on needs that emerge internally, based on needs that we observe in the scientific and drug development community and work with others across many areas to pursue these important applied regulatory science questions.
Does this mean that you're open to suggestions from industry sponsors to conduct specific research projects as well?
We're always open for suggestions and discussion. And as I mentioned, this our collaborations with industry and interactions most commonly occur through the public-private partnerships. For instance, we're very involved with the Cardiac Safety Research Consortium, with the HESI Group, Health and Environmental Sciences Institute. We work with the Critical Path Institute and many others. So yes, we always want to hear from the outside community as far as what are the important questions they see. And then we work and discuss internally if this is something we want to invest our internal resources in. We try and focus on things where FDA can really provide unique value.
Do you make recommendations to the review divisions for consideration of your findings in their review work, or do you put the findings out there for them to consider using or not using?
Yes, we do. We provide written review consults, participating in internal meetings with our review colleagues in the various review divisions. And then for broader scientific research, we do that often isn't on a one specific product, but will cover a series of products where we're developing new tools, standards, and approaches to make drug development more efficient. We will always present that work at meetings and publish it in the peer-reviewed literature.
Moving to the legislative arena for a moment, in relation to regulatory science, I wonder, what are your biggest hopes for or any concerns about the FDA user fee reauthorization, PDUFA 6, which the U.S. Congress has now approved and sent to the White House for signature?
An exciting focus in PDUFA 6 is model-informed drug development. Model-informed drug development refers to exposure-based, biological, and statistical models that can be derived from preclinical and or clinical data sources. In the Office of Clinical Pharmacology, under PDUFA 6, we will likely develop the regulatory science and review expertise and capacity in model-informed drug development. We will also convene a series of workshops, publish guidance documents, and develop policies and procedures for translating modeling approaches into regulatory review. And we will conduct a pilot program where FDA will grant a pair of meetings to sponsors participating in the pilot that will consist of an initial and a follow-up meeting on the model-informed drug development issue. A challenge will be letting internal and external stakeholders know what model-informed drug development is, what is available to them in terms of resources, and how to develop and consistently apply policy.
How will sponsors find out about these opportunities? Will there be federal registered notices or other mechanisms of communication?
This opportunity has been described in the PDUFA 6 goals letter that was previously published before the legislation. And yes, there will be more communication as this goes forward.
Moving to a bit of science, how does applied regulatory science intersect with the growing fields of precision medicine and translational medicine? And specifically, I wanted to ask you, does your division have collaborations with NIH, particularly with NCATS, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences?
Advancing precision medicine and translational medicine are major priorities for us at FDA. To do this, we also need to translate new drug development tools such as biomarkers and predictive models into the regulatory review process. A recent example is the expanded indication for the drug ivacaftor to treat additional mutations of cystic fibrosis. Because hundreds of rare mutations exist that can lead to cystic fibrosis, it is very difficult to enroll sufficient numbers of patients with each mutation in clinical trials. And because of this, previously, ivacaftor was only approved for patients with one of 10 different mutations. However, we were able to expand approval to 33 total mutations based in part on an in vitro cell-based assay that expressed each mutation separately. And as part of the review team, our division carefully evaluated the raw data submitted by the sponsor to be able to reproduce results and ensure data quality. And these data are now included in the drug label. And this is an example of the unique role that the Division of Applied Regulatory Science plays as active laboratory researchers and reviewers of complex laboratory assays to speed drug development. In terms of your second question related to collaboration with NIH and NCATS, we have participated as advisors to NCATS and DARPA in their microphysiological systems or organ on a chip program. And moving forward, we are bringing these organ on a chip systems into our laboratories at FDA to characterize them and assess potential contexts of use in drug development and regulatory review. We're very excited about this. Some people in the community talk about using these for replacing animal toxicity studies. I think we are a little ways away from that. However, that doesn't mean these very exciting new devices can't be quite useful right now. I think the key is to identify gaps where our current models are inadequate and qualify the organ on a chip systems as fit for purpose models. This is what we are looking to do for the in vitro and in silico cardiac safety model I discussed earlier. And there's no reason why we can't do the same thing for microphysiological systems.
I'm pleased that you mentioned modeling several times in our conversation. I wanted to ask you, what role do you think modeling and simulation will play in clinical trials for common diseases as well as for rare diseases? How can these trials support regulatory decision making?
Applying modeling and simulation in clinical trials is a major focus for us in the Office of Clinical Pharmacology. And this focus is likely to be expanded under PDUFA 6. FDA Commissioner Dr. Gottlieb described some of our work in a recent FDA Voice blog on in silico clinical trials. We use modeling and simulation to predict clinical outcomes, inform clinical trial designs, support evidence of effectiveness, optimize dosing, predict product safety, and evaluate potential adverse event mechanisms. We also use modeling and simulation to incorporate aspects of individual physiology and genetics in drug metabolizing enzymes to identify patient subgroups that need dose adjustments. And these methods are being applied to both common and rare diseases. For example, FDA is collaborating with scientists to develop natural history models based on placebo arms in Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and muscular dystrophy. And an important objective of modeling and simulation in clinical trials is to better evaluate the behavior of new treatments in rare disease populations that are inherently hard to study due to their small sample size.
FDA recently discussed the potential for extrapolation to different patient populations based on modeling and simulation. Do you see limitations in using these models, and what settings would be ideal for such uses? You've mentioned a few. Perhaps you have others in mind.
An important objective of modeling and simulation is to assess the behavior of new treatments in populations that are difficult to study. For example, in pediatric drug development, we use an integrated approach that leverages data from adults to ensure efficient, informative, and successful clinical trials. Another example, in the development of counterterrorism agents, which clearly represents a challenge, clinical development is heavily guided by modeling and extrapolation of data from animal experiments. And a limitation is that these models are only as good as the data that goes into training and testing them. In addition, it is important for there to be transparency of the assumptions that go into the models, and it can be challenging to get non-modelers comfortable with model-informed decision-making if they are not familiar. Overall, they are ideal for settings where clinical trials are impractical or unethical to perform, And for common diseases, they are ideal for designing the most efficient clinical trials that are most likely to succeed.
You mentioned persuading and non-modelers about the usefulness of such models. What are some of the approaches you might adopt to persuade the non-believers, if you will?
I think the best approach is to demonstrate usefulness where we can fill in gaps, make drug development more efficient. This requires integrated community efforts where we are getting input and contribution from within FDA, among our review colleagues, from industry, from academia. And it's really by bringing together the different stakeholders, developing robust validation or qualification plans, that we can bring useful models to the drug development and regulatory review space.
FDA recently published its FY 2015-2016 Regulatory Science Progress Report. Moving forward, what opportunities do you see for FDA to continue to advance regulatory science?
We need new tools, standards, and approaches to improve the scientific assessment of the safety, efficacy, quality, and performance of medical products. There is a unique role for FDA scientists to perform applied research to move new science into the regulatory review process. As we have also discussed, better biomarkers and predictive models have the potential to identify safety concerns earlier in drug development and predict therapeutic effectiveness to decrease the burden of clinical trials. These tools are needed for new drugs and also for complex generic drugs and biosimilars. This can lead to more competition in the marketplace and lower drug costs. There are opportunities for FDA to advance regulatory science in the rapidly evolving fields of precision medicine and genomics. And to do this, we need expert scientists in the agency to determine how to bring targeted therapies to market when large clinical trials cannot be performed. We discuss an example where this includes using in vitro assays for patient selection for rare genetic diseases, also using genomic biomarkers and human-induced pluripotent stem cell assays. Moving forward, our multidisciplinary and translational research staff will continue to advance all these areas, but we cannot do it on our own. To be most effective, we need to expand our collaborations with other government agencies such as NIH and with industry and academia through public-private partnerships. We all have the same goal to bring safe and effective medicines to patients sooner.
We all see scientific research advancing quite rapidly these days, as you pointed out. And some people feel that regulators really must make every effort to keep up with the rapid advancement in science so as to be able to bring products to patients as rapidly as possible. Sounds like your division really is at the cusp of keeping up with scientific advancements, if I understand you correctly. Do you have enough resources to do so and to ensure that major regulatory agencies like FDA does keep up with scientific advances and help translate them into products that people can use?
We always want to do more. And as you mentioned, there are so many cutting-edge scientific technologies bringing new therapies to patients and other technologies we want to bring into the drug review process. And the more resources we have, the more we can do.
That brings us to the end of our conversation. Dr. Strauss, thank you very much for your time today, for your insights, and good luck with your important work.
Thank you very much.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.